The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Love. Courage. Truth. Glenn Beck.
Good morning. It's the Glenn Beck program. Happy New Year from all of us here. My name is Mike Broomhead. I'm in Phoenix, Arizona. My last day in for Glenn. So let's get to it. Holiday spending, the numbers are in, and record-setting spending this holiday season. How did all of this happen? If you remember, the president, our former president, said, thanks, Obama, while extolling all the virtues of what's been going on for the last 12 months. Now, largely, Americans vote with their wallets. So how does this play out in the coming election year that will begin January 1st? We will be in the midterm election year. If you listen to all of the pundits, the chances of Donald Trump becoming president were very, very small. I believed it like everybody else did. There was only one person on our radio show when we did our election night coverage that thought Donald Trump was going to win. Everybody else thought it was going to be a walkover for Hillary Clinton, myself included. And we bought into the hype. And people kept saying there were these people that were afraid to say they were voting for Donald Trump because of the backlash from the media and the backlash from a very vocal group of people turned out to be true. People voting with their wallets. There was an agenda set forward by this president in which he said he wanted to fix the economy, America first. Well, he was called a nationalist and he was called an isolationist and he was called a Nazi. And this is how Hitler did things. It was all about patriotism. And so he's been compared to Hitler since day one. Well, so was George W. Bush. So was Reagan. I mean, it's just kind of the mantra of people. Now, the problem for the president, in my opinion, is the fight with the media that's been picked that he's not really shied away from. Don't necessarily blame him, but his style is in your face. He dragged the media with him through the primary process. They were real numbers when you saw the amount of free press that was given to Donald Trump during the primary because he was such a controversial figure. He said so many things to and about the media, to and about his opponents on the dais during that, you know, that what was there, 37 Republican candidates, that he was able to get over $1 billion worth of free coverage because of the way he handled the election cycle. But now he's the president and the economy seems to be responding to his business ideas. Now, America largely votes with their wallets, not the partisan politics that goes on in the primary, but when it comes time for a general election, people vote with their wallet. And if that's an indicator of the midterm elections, we keep hearing that the Republicans are in trouble in the House. They have a very good reason to worry. The numbers show this. Generic ballots show this happening and that happening. Well, we'll see. It's going to be a long year. Holiday spending. U.S. department store stocks jump on holiday spending record. Tuesday, MasterCard said shoppers spent over $800 billion during the season, more than ever before. So the economy has been growing at a very slow pace over the last 8 years. We hit rock bottom, the end of the Bush presidency, the housing bubble that burst, people short selling and losing their homes. The economy was down. The stock market crashed. In comes President Obama. The stimulus spending that was supposed to fix things. By the way, the agenda for President Trump moving forward into the next election year, Mitch McConnell saying, and this is something we're going to get into, Mitch McConnell saying that the agenda for the Senate can't be to take up the benefits and take up what's going on in Washington, D.C. and entitlement programs, because the Senate Democrats aren't really going to go along with that. So they're going to work on infrastructure. Correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't the stimulus package about shovel-ready jobs and infrastructure? Didn't we fix the highways and the bridges like 8 years ago? I'm just asking the question because we spent $1 trillion in a stimulus package that I thought we're supposed to fix the infrastructure of the United States. All we ever hear after that is the infrastructure is broken. What happened to that $1 trillion? But we know that the agenda for the president moving forward, he talks about a bipartisan infrastructure bill to bring some of the Democrats on board. They're not going to want to do that. It's an election year and they want to win back the House. So I don't know that they're going to go along with anything. But holiday spending is not a partisan issue, nor is the stock market. The Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P, all of them up. The Dow is going to add 5,000 points for the first time ever in a year, ever. You can argue about politics and numbers a lot of times, but in the end, it doesn't matter. The partisan Republicans and the partisan Democrats are going to vote that way. The candidates that are able to talk to that large swath of people down the middle. So here in Arizona, where I am, the answer is going to be for people that are trying to win their seat back or people that are trying to take seats from someone else, where do you stand on the economy? Because in the end, that's where it's going to end up. Where I live, the unemployment rate is down as low as I think as it's ever been. But nationally, holiday spending at $800 billion, higher than we've ever spent, more money than we've ever spent. That's not a fluke. Now, whether you give Donald Trump all of the credit for that, consumer confidence is very high. When consumer confidence is very high, incumbents tend to win. That's the way it's always been, with a few anomalies here and there, but that is the way it usually is. You will go with the status quo. Why ruin a good thing? Why fix something that ain't broke? We can do all the cliches we want to for the next 3 hours. But MasterCard said we spent $800 billion. The stock market is a nonpartisan indicator. You are seeing business owners now, they will begin to invest. Now, especially in this next year, what's interesting about this is if you are going to see a huge jump in anything as far as spending and manufacturing, it will be in the next 12 months because businesses taking advantage of the tax cuts to begin next year for them, being able to take advantage of the write-offs by purchases that they make, you will see that in the first 12 months of 2018. Now, how it carries over into 2019 is another story. But if 2018 being an election year and we watch the stock market continue to climb, we see manufacturing numbers go up, we see unemployment numbers go down, wages going up for people. How are people going to vote? I mean, just based on that. The report said holiday sales in stores and online between November 1st and December 24th rose 4.9%. The fastest year-on-year pace of increase since 2011. MasterCard, which tracks spending by combined sales activity in its payment network with estimates of cash and other payment forms, excludes automobile sales from its figures. So retailers had their stocks tumble this year as they continue to lose sales to online stores like Amazon. Shares in JCPenney rose 7.6% on Tuesday. Kohl's, 5.8%. Macy's, 5.1%. Nordstrom's, 2.8%. Online sales rose 18.1% during the holiday season. But that's probably only 11 or 12% of total retail sales. The bulk of sales are still very much in stores, according to people. And it was true. So if sales are up, if stores are beginning to see their stocks go up again, and we know retailers are in trouble, the brick and mortar stores are in trouble per square foot, what they pay in rent compared to the people that go in when they buy online. But if you went out holiday shopping, Christmas shopping, as I did, like everybody else did, you know that those stores were busy. Jewelry stores backed up. I mean, just crowded. And you're seeing people buying gifts and spending more than they had before is an indicator of a good economy. So if that's the case, which now it appears with this spending is the case, if the left wants to say that's all Obama, okay, they can do that. It's not going to work with the average American family. The average American will go with the status quo when things are going well. That's how the voters vote. The hard left and the hard right are already set in their ways. If you're listening to this show, chances are you are someone that is invested and you vote in primaries and you watch candidates for a long time. You don't jump in at the last minute. You don't go with somebody that you feel votes like you. You do your homework. But you also are not the typical voter in a general election, which is why in primaries you see people sprint left and right depending on their party and sprint to the middle for a general because there is a huge swath of people that they have to speak to. It's going to be easier for Republicans next year to speak to constituents and to speak to potential voters. If you're a Republican, it's going to be a lot easier to go to them and say, look where the economy is going. The Democrats are going to have to hit this head on, and I'm going to explain to you how they're going to do that. Bernie Sanders speaks, Krugman speaks, and it's as if they are living in a different planet from most of us. So coming up at 7:20, we'll tell you how they feel about it and how they are crafting the argument. Krugman says America's not dead yet, but the way he starts that op-ed piece would make you think he is living in an alternate universe. So all that's coming up next. My name is Mike Broomhead, and this is the Glenn Beck Program.
Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck.
Happy New Year. Merry Christmas from the Glenn Beck Program. My name is Mike Broomhead. I am in Phoenix, Arizona. I'll be here the rest of the day, and then Doc Thompson comes up tomorrow. And social media users, I'm going to tell you how you can reach out to me again. I want to thank everybody for all of the outreach yesterday. But let's get to Senator Sanders, what Bernie Sanders had to say. Now, this was printed yesterday, and it's a CNN story. New tax bill, a disaster for the American people. So far, the economy disagrees with you, Senator. And so the excuses that they make are hysterical. 10 years from now, look what's going to happen. Well, you can fix it. The Congress can fix that anytime they want, which is why the door was left open. We should have made those tax cuts permanent for the middle class. Couldn't. 60 senators wouldn't get on board. Weren't able to. So they made the business tax cuts permanent with the simple majority, and they can make the other tax cuts permanent when you get 60 votes from the senators. This is not the last time this is going to happen. This is why the Democrats desperately want to take back the House of Representatives, because if the Republicans continue to control the House and the Senate, if they gain seats in the Senate, which the suspicion is against all the other media attention you're hearing, 25 Democrats are up for re-election in this election cycle. Do you think that all of those Democrats are going to retain their seats? I don't. So the Republicans could actually add seats in the United States Senate. Now, there are a couple of things that are throwing a monkey wrench into all of this, and both of them are in the state of Arizona. Jeff Flake has announced earlier this year that he would not seek re-election, which means there is no incumbent in one of the Senate seats in Arizona that's up for grabs. So Jeff Flake's seat is up for grabs, which means it could be anyone's. He has got a very formidable opponent on the Democrat side. Her name is Kyrsten Sinema. She is a House member. She was in the state legislature here for a long time. She has really done a great job of crafting a reputation of being kind of a moderate Democrat, because she's in a very moderate district in the House here in Arizona. But her track record when she was in the state legislature is very, very liberal, bordering on communism, that's not an insult, by the way. It's an observation. She is a single payer supporter, I believe, and she's going to have to answer a lot of those questions. But she's going to be a very tough person to beat in a state that has been a red state for a very long time, because the other people coming forward, there is a veteran, her name is Martha McSally. She is a House member. She may be giving up her seat to run against Kyrsten Sinema. Dr. Kelly Ward is already in the race. Kelly Ward is an adamant Trump supporter, former state legislator. She's been in the race. She's been the only Republican in a race for a long time. Polling numbers showed her beating Jeff Flake very soundly in a primary. Part of the reason why I believe Senator Flake stepped away. And so that's a monkey wrench there. But what about the future of John McCain in the Senate? And now, I am a friend of Senator McCain. I respect Senator McCain. A lot of people very upset with me about that are far right. I will tell you this. I don't agree with Senator McCain on things politically many times, but he has treated me with respect. He has been very kind to me. He is a friend. And I think the world personally of John McCain. I'm never going to back away from that. I know him personally. And as a man, as a human being, he has been very, very good to me. So I'm not wishing anything ill on him. I'm not wishing that he would retire or leave office. But if he can't perform his job, if he decides he has to leave, that would be two seats open, depending on when that happens. If he were to keep his seat through the end of May, then the governor, after the end of May, if it happened June or later, that John McCain decided he could no longer continue, and I'm not predicting any of this is going to happen, then our governor would appoint a replacement for that seat, which would be another Republican, would be appointed to that seat until the next general election, which wouldn't be this November. It would be too soon. It would be 2 years later. There would be an election held then. So somebody would sit in that seat for 2 years. They would have to run for another 2 years because John McCain's seat is not up for 4 years. Hope that makes sense to all of you. If John McCain, for some reason, were to resign his seat before the end of May, then there would be two Senate seats up for grabs in the state of Arizona. Both seats would be available this November. Or John McCain finishes out his term. Those are kind of the options and the monkey wrench in there. But nobody believes, or at least I don't believe, that the Democrats are going to win all 25 of the seats that they have up for grabs. Just doesn't make sense that they are. So the mantra from the left is going to be, this is horrible. You may be seeing results in your paycheck right now, but I'm telling you, it's coming. The tsunami's coming. And if we don't get the Democrats in power to fix the impending tsunami, you're in big trouble. Bernie Sanders, look at all the people that are going to lose health insurance. No, they're not. Because of the end of the mandate, which means you're not forced to buy it, people will choose to not buy it. They didn't lose their insurance. They opt out. There are so many people that have an opportunity to buy health insurance through their employer. When you're young, when you're 10 feet tall and bulletproof as a 23, 24, 25-year-old single, especially man, no kids, you're not married, you're 10 feet tall and bulletproof. I'm not spending money on health insurance. What do I need health insurance for? That's when it's offered through your employer. Does that mean you don't have health insurance? Yes, it does. So Bernie Sanders takes those numbers of people that are not going to buy Obamacare through the exchanges when they're not forced to with the mandates and says they're losing their health insurance. It's all a part of the mantra to tell you how bad it's going to be, because they can no longer tell you how bad it is, because it's not. Stock market setting records. Your 401k climbing at an alarming rate. Housing prices up over 6% the first year of the presidency. Now, whether he gets all the credit for that or not, the American people vote the status quo when things are going well. So Bernie Sanders says this is a disaster for the American people. He told that to Wolf Blitzer. I think the Republicans will rue the day. He said this the day it was passed. They may be celebrating today, but I have a feeling that next November they won't be celebrating quite as much. All right. Well, we'll see if that happens. So Paul Krugman, with what I believe is a view, it's like he's living on another planet. Paul Krugman, most of us came into 2017 expecting the worst, and in many ways, the worst is what we got. Did we? Okay. Donald Trump has been every bit as horrible as one might have expected. He continues day after day to prove himself utterly unfit for office, morally and intellectually. And the Republican Party, including so-called moderates, turns out, if anything, to be even worse than one might have expected. At this point, it's evidently composed entirely of cynical, willing to sell out every principle and every shred of their own dignity as long as their donors get big tax cuts. There you have it. It's all about the rich versus poor, class warfare. It's us versus them. The Democrats win with us versus them. It's white versus black, man versus woman, rich versus poor, gay versus straight. It's always segmented society. They have the gay voters, they have the black voters, they have the women voters, they have the poor voters, they have everybody segmented in society. And that's how they divide and conquer. That's been their plan forever. Well, this year is going to be more of the haves and the have-nots than ever before. They will point out to you big corporate tax cuts. They will point out to you salaries and the rich getting richer. They'll point out the stock market and the rich get richer. Well, the fact of the matter is you do too. IRA, 401k, looking to retire someday, helps you. Helps you a lot. Coming up just after the bottom of the hour, we will talk about the UN, because the president said, you don't want to vote with us when it comes to Israel. That's fine. How much do we actually pay of the UN's budget, the United States? What do we pay of the UN's budget? And what did Nikki Haley do with the budget cuts? It's a great story. 7:35, that's what we talk about. Stick around.
Glenn Beck. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
All right, fact check. Former White House advisor Sebastian Gorka said that the U.S. pays over 20% of the U.N. budget. When factoring the military side, we pay almost a third at 28%. The verdict on the fact check, absolutely true. The U.S. must pay 22% of the U.N. budget for 2016 to 2018. They contribute an even higher share with some of the agencies within the U.N. Why is this important? Well, we all understand why it's important. We understand that the U.N. and how some of the workings of the U.N. are sheer idiocy. The U.N. determines the required contribution levels each state. It's based on a bunch of factors like national income and debt. The U.S. paid 22% of the U.N.'s $5.4 billion budget for 2016 and 2017. They allocated $1.2 billion toward the budget during these years. It's the maximum contribution allowed. U.S. funding of the U.N. operations is under scrutiny after 128 member states voted to condemn the decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. By the way, let's talk about that decision. I'm sure it's been mentioned on this network before, but if not, let's clear something up. The Democrats are outraged about something that they agree with. Let's be very clear about this. The last four Democratic platforms all stated that Jerusalem must be recognized as the capital of Israel. It's in every party platform for the last four platforms, every single one of them. So go back and look. Is that 16 years? Go back and look. The Democrats have been pounding this drum. The largest bipartisan political action committee, or PAC, in the entire country is AIPAC, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee. It is truly a bipartisan organization. The Arizona AIPAC luncheon I've been to a number of times, and you see a cross-section of some very, very prominent Republicans and Democrats enthusiastically there supporting Israel. This is not a partisan issue. All of a sudden, Donald Trump decides to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel officially by moving our embassy there. Well, he's not doing anything that hasn't been proclaimed by the Republicans and the Democrats for the better part of two decades. And all of a sudden now the Democrats say he's going to start World War III, the violence in the streets, the uprising. Even the New York Times had to admit that didn't happen. As a matter of fact, now about 10 nations are considering doing the exact same thing. Guatemala says it's going to. Now, Guatemala is not exactly a superpower, but you are seeing other nations saying exactly the same thing, that Jerusalem should be the capital of Israel. And incidentally, if you talk to the people that go to Israel on a regular basis that know the nation, when anybody, when the Palestinians come into Jerusalem, they shop, they're welcomed, they're safe. When an Israeli goes to Gaza, not so much. Golda Meir, some of my favorite quotes are from Golda Meir. And a couple of them are should tell you the mindset of the Israelis versus the mindset of the Palestinians that would fight. And Golda Meir said of the Palestinians that we, the PLO specifically, but said of the Palestinians, we can forgive you for killing our grandchildren. We cannot forgive you for forcing us to kill yours. Also quoted as saying, if the Palestinians would put down their weapons, there would be peace. If the Israelis were to put down their weapons, there would be no Israel. And there's a lot of truth in both of those statements. The U.S. has been and continues to be the strongest ally to Israel. They continue to be our strongest ally in the region. And the President of the United States has decided to do what both parties have put in their platforms now for years and make it official. So when you say something, words without deeds, right? Words without deeds are dead. And the president decides we're going to do it, and the world is furious. Okay, let them be. So in response, Nikki Haley called the resolution disrespectful because the U.S. pays more than any other country. When we make generous contributions to the U.N., we also have a legitimate expectation that our goodwill is recognized and respected. Nikki Haley has announced a 285 million cut to the UN budget. And the crowd goes wild. So there you have it. The United Nations has agreed on a 2018-2019 budget that includes steep reductions in spending. The upcoming biennial UN budget will drop by $285 million, or about 5% from the 2016-2017 level. Haley says it's a big step in the right direction. The inefficiency and overspending of the United Nations are well known. We will no longer let the generosity of the American people be taken advantage of or remain unchecked. Feels good, doesn't it? I mean, it does to me. I mean, the United Nations, didn't they put Iran on their Human Rights Committee? I mean, really, let's be honest about some of the things the United Nations. I'm not saying you throw the entire organization overboard. There's a lot of Americans that believe get us out of the UN, but I'm not even saying that. But we're seeing now how some of these things are changing. A lot of people are not fans of how the president does things. And he comes across as a bull in the china shop a lot of times. But what did he say about NATO? We're out. We're getting out of NATO. Looks like it's running a lot more smoothly. NAFTA. Getting out of NAFTA. And everybody screams, can't get out of NAFTA. It's going to be terrible. We can't. So somebody sat the president down and said, you know, there are a bunch of things in the North American Free Trade Agreement that can be fixed. And if we sit down and talk about them instead of getting out of NAFTA, and the president, all right, let's talk. And both the Canadian and the Mexican leaders said, let's sit down and talk. Let's talk about a NAFTA that's good for all three nations, that makes all three nations work together when they do things like tariffs and when they do things so that we're not fighting amongst ourselves in this tariff war, that a unified North America is a great trading partner. So, I'm not saying everything the president's touching is turning to gold. I'm saying there's some method to the madness sometimes. If the UN is going to pass a resolution where it's denounced by so many nations, where some of our friends sided with us and some of our friends just abstained from voting, and then America says, okay, that's fine, then we're going to cut back. The generosity's not going to be there. They have a right to vote the way they want to vote, absolutely, without a doubt. And the Americans have a right to take their toys and go home. And there's something to be said for that. Now, a lot of people think it's horrible. I don't at all. Now, they should do some things with the budgets, the United States budgets for the different departments of our government when they're putting this together, because the same principle applies. The redundancy and the waste in the American budget and all of the federal agencies that are tied to it, we could wipe out 10% of just about every department of the government's budget and just get rid of redundancy and waste and not change 1 ounce of service provided by any one of them. If there was just some strict oversight. So Nikki Haley making this announcement. So we will remember when this is what the president said. We will remember it when we are called upon to once again make the world's largest contribution to the United Nations. Well, Haley said this on behalf of the president. And we will remember it when so many countries come calling on us, as they so often do, to pay even more, to use our influence or for their benefit. The final budget cut exceeds the $200 million reduction targeted for the budget. Haley says the U.S. will look for other areas in which it can make additional cuts. While we are pleased with the results of this year's budget negotiations, you can be sure we will continue to look at ways to increase the U.N.'s efficiency while protecting our interests. Once again, America first. What you think of that? Coming up, the NFL cancels their Sunday night game. Doesn't sound like a big deal, but let's talk about what's happening with the National Football League. Is this really a byproduct of what the fans are saying is a slap in their face with the kneeling for the national anthem? Or is it just retribution because people don't want sports used for a political platform? All that coming up before we close out this hour. Again, if you're a social media user, on Twitter, I am at Broomhead Show, and my last name is spelled just like it sounds. So at Broomhead Show on Twitter. The Mike Broomhead Show fan page is available on Facebook. And if you're an Instagram user, I post a lot of blurry pictures. It is just Mike Broomhead, all one word, no underscores, no dots, no dashes. That's how you can find me on social media. Love the interaction. I'll be back to talk NFL. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck.
Hey, thanks for being here this morning. It's a Glenn Beck program. My name is Mike Broomhead in Phoenix, Arizona. In this morning, my final day this year in for the Glenn Beck program. So I thank you for spending part of your day with me. The NFL has canceled their final Sunday night football game for a number of reasons. Part of it because it's New Year's Eve, one of the lowest TV days of the year. But there's no doubt that the NFL numbers are down. So the reason for this is up in the air for a lot of people, and it's not for me. Now, I side with the people that say kneeling is disrespectful and sends the wrong message. I also believe burning the flag sends the wrong message. But I will say this, there's a First Amendment right to express yourself. The First Amendment is there to protect controversial speech. I don't like it. I hate it. I think it's a wrong thing to do many, many times. But I also believe that you have a right to do these things, unless, of course, you're an employee and your bosses say you represent us. There is a long precedent set that employers look at people. There was a woman in the D.C. area that was on her bicycle and the president's motorcade drove by and she decided the best way to salute the president was to give him the finger. Well, then she took that picture and she posted it, made her a Facebook profile picture, private picture. The employer was a defense contractor, bad for business, you're out. Long precedent. My company, you know, I have a public profile on Facebook, the Mike Broomhead Show, and I have a private. But I can't do things on my private page that would make my employer look bad. They'll get rid of me. So the NFL has the ability to step in and stop this. For whatever reason, they've decided not to, which is why there is a bit of a backlash. That coupled along with a great college football season that's going on right now. Now, I am unashamedly a Miami Hurricanes fan, have been my entire life growing up in Southwest Florida. And Miami, the college football is more interesting when the U is back, the turnover chain and all the other stuff that goes with it. So there is now an option for people to go back and watch really good quality football if you're a football fan and exciting games with some of the best teams in the country. I mean, you look at the top teams right now and how they're playing and what they're doing and the teams that deserve to be there. You know, Clemson, Alabama, Georgia, Oklahoma, this is going to be a great playoff. So there's a number of reasons why the numbers could be down for the NFL. But there's no doubt that the political stance taken by players has hurt them. People talk about unintended consequences all the time. If I say something that insults somebody, that may not have been my intent, but once I know I've insulted that person, political correctness dictates that I alter my behavior because the unintended consequence of my actions or my words offended or hurt somebody's feelings. Well, I don't believe these NFL players, when they took a knee, many of them, meant to insult the police officers in the stadiums that are protecting them or the men and women who have defended the country as veterans that show up at NFL games wearing the jersey of the team they love and a hat from the branch of the service they served. I don't think they meant to hurt those people's feelings, but for many of them, they did. And instead of saying, we've got a message we want to get out, and A, this isn't helping get our message out, and B, we never meant to offend people. Instead, many of them going strong, not going to alter it. Well, people are walking away. For me, it's about the controversy. You see, I do this for a living, and I love it. I love what I do. But sports is an escape for me. You know, at the high school level, when my brother and his buddies played high school football, and I was involved in the coaching staff in a very small way, I coached Pop Warner football. It was about the development of young men. It was about learning to win with grace and lose with dignity, about getting kicked in the stomach with a disappointing loss, and having, you know, tears on the sidelines and days to get over it. But years later, realize nothing bad really happened. It was a high school football game. And that's the way sports is for people. It's an escape. Well, I don't want to go to my escape and be faced with politics. I don't want to argue with somebody else in the stands next to me whether or not NFL players should or shouldn't kneel. I don't want to talk about police brutality. I don't want to talk about hands up, don't shoot. I want to watch football. And there's a backlash. The NFL, we used to print money. It had so much of it. Now they're seeing a bit of a backlash. NBA ratings up over Christmas. NFL ratings down. Now they're canceling the final Sunday night football game of the year. Indicator, they better straighten up their act in the offseason. I just think that's what they need to do. Once again, we'll talk about the holiday spending, exactly how much of it was there. How good was it for the U.S. economy? What does it say going into the election year? That, and we'll talk about the increase in homicide rates in America.
Glenn Beck. Love. Courage. Truth. Glenn Beck.
Hi, my name is Mike Broomhead in for Glenn today. Thanks for joining the show, being a part of it. My name is Mike Broomhead again from Phoenix, Arizona. Wishing you a Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. Hope you got big plans. Hope it's been a great holiday season. The holiday spending numbers are in, coupled with the growth we've seen over the last year. Things are looking good in the momentum of the economy going into 2018. The question, this is what is so funny about this, is the question now politically is, who does it benefit? And it's so funny that we look at the world that way. We have seen sluggish growth for the last 8 years. The policies are just different, and it's okay to like them. I think they were wrong for America. There are many people that disagreed with me because Barack Obama was elected twice. But the economic growth wasn't there, and a lot of it has to do with expertise and focus. Barack Obama said he was going to fundamentally transform America, and I believe that's what his agenda was to do, and that's exactly what he tried to do. Economically, it did not work the way they had hoped. They were warned about Obamacare and how bad it was going to be for America. They were warned that it would not work the way they wanted to do it. And it didn't. It was an abysmal failure. And there's no way around those numbers. You can talk about people that have health insurance that didn't, and then those numbers may be accurate. Not worth the expense. There's a better way of doing things. There always is. And instead of listening, they just went full steam ahead. Immigration, the border policies of the Obama administration, against what a lot of Americans believed. But he was elected twice. He was my president. I never said he wasn't. But now we're seeing, after those 8 years, the president, the former president, giving a speech, making a statement about the economy and talked about the growth and what was happening, and then said, thanks, Obama, as if he put the wheels in motion and got this thing spinning, and Donald Trump is reaping the benefits of Barack Obama's work. People on the left are going to try to say it. People on the left are going to try to believe it. But the American people are not going to buy it. Donald Trump is a businessman. Love him or hate him, that's what he is. And he said the way to fuel the economy is to give people back more of their own money. Don't for a minute think it was the white nationalists and the Nazis that elected Donald Trump. That's not who elected Donald Trump. Donald Trump won swing states by small margins, but states that people thought he had no business or no possibility of winning. How? He went into those swing states and he said to those people, those working class families, many of them Democrats, 206 counties, he said, we are going to lower the taxes and the regulation on your bosses. So those manufacturing jobs that pay between $20 and $30 an hour are going to remain here. Your bosses will repatriate dollars. They won't take your manufacturing jobs to other countries. They'll expand the existing manufacturing outfits that they have here. And we're going to keep people like you working in your jobs. In the meantime, Hillary Clinton was told, don't even come to West Virginia. Why? Because she told the American people, we're going to put the coal industry out of business. Then we're going to come in with government programs and we're going to retrain the coal miners that have worked for generations in those coal mines to doing different jobs. We're not going to forget about you, West Virginia. We're going to turn your lives upside down. We're going to get rid of the coal industry. But then we're going to come in and train you for another job. She was told, don't even bother coming to West Virginia. So the American people believe Donald Trump 206 counties that twice voted for Barack Obama voted for Donald Trump. So all of a sudden they're racist? They voted for Obama twice. Now they're racist. So don't believe that for a moment. So the entire first year was all disappointments. Can't get health care done. Can't get health care reform done. Can't get health insurance reform done. Well, that's because the Republicans were dumb enough to put deadlines on themselves. Then they got a tax bill passed. Holiday spending has set a record. According to MasterCard, the American people between November 1st and December 24th spent $800 billion. $800 billion. The highest spending in history. Up 4.9% year over year, the biggest since 2011. So, you look at those increases, you look at the stock market, 5,000 points up in 1 year for the first time ever, and you ask yourself, how in this day and age, when you go into an election year, is the momentum not on the side of the Republicans? And I'll tell you how. Because if you watch or listen to the traditional media, they will tell you either this is a flash in the pan, this is an anomaly, or this is something that is going to get the rich richer and it's going to crash down upon the middle class any day. That's the mantra from the left. Bernie Sanders says this is the worst thing ever for the American people because 10 years from now, this is what's going to happen with taxes. 10 years from now. That's five sessions of Congress. You mean the two-year term of a member of the House of Representatives, they aren't able to fix whatever the impending doom you say is possible? Well, that's why the Republicans have to be out. That's why we have to have Democrats in charge. It's going to be the mantra. So what they are going to do is they are going to pull the Wizard of Oz trick on you. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. Pay no attention to what your wallet is doing. Don't look at your 401k. I know right now your 401k is up. Oh, by the way, if you own a home, average home prices are up over 6%. First year for the Trump presidency. I'm not calling this person, I'm not saying Donald Trump is the savior of the world. I mentioned yesterday, I have become a Trump defender because the traditional media won't give him credit for anything. Again, CNN with the headlines. Tax plan gets passed, many Americans still skeptical. Donald Trump gets two scoops of ice cream on his for dessert. Everybody else only gets one. These are actual CNN headlines. And I've got a full list of even more. The Melania Trump thing. If you didn't see that, Newsweek said Melania Trump orders 200-year-old tree cut down at the White House. You know what really happened? There was a tree that is being completely supported by outside means. This tree is dead standing. It's a danger and it's a hazard, said the arborists that have been taking care of it and propping it up falsely for years. And it finally needs to come down before it just crumbles down and hurts somebody. But Newsweek reports Melania Trump orders 200-year-old tree to be... Okay. What's next? Donald Trump kicked a baby today. You just never know. So I've become a defender. But the numbers speak for themselves. And the American people will respond accordingly. I'm not calling it a walkover for Republicans. The Republicans are known for snatching defeat out of the jaws of victory over and over again. The Republicans a lot of times can't get out of their own way. There is a tax plan in place that is going to save real people, real money, and they couldn't sell it to the American people. The Republican Party could lose money owning a bar in Vegas. I mean, they can't get out of their own way sometimes. Their PR department doesn't defend anything because they won't defend anything. They won't dare defend wealthy people in America. They won't dare defend the business owners by name or say, you know, you're right. Those wealthy business owners are getting a big tax cut. We are cutting taxes on businesses. You know why? So they can pay you more. I traveled around the valley here in Phoenix, Arizona. I traveled with the vice president and our governor one day and watched them talk with small business owners about what would happen if this tax plan were to pass. This was months ago. And every small business owner had a different story. One was a dentist. He said, I'm not going to expand my business, but I'm going to pay my employees more. He said, because, you know, the insurance companies dictate reimbursements and the costs continue to go up. So the window of what I can pay employees continues to shrink. So this tax cut will allow me to pay my employees what they deserve. Another couple owned a garage and they had 12 mechanics or 12 bays where they did car repairs. He said, we can buy tools and equipment. His wife said, we used to provide health insurance coverage for our employees, but because of the cost of Obamacare and the increased cost in health insurance, we weren't able to anymore. This tax cut will help us with that benefit package for our employees. A furniture refurbishment company, a husband and wife, one employee, said, we turn work away because we don't have the employees to do the work. If we have this tax cut, we can expand the size of our building. We're already looking at a piece of property, and we can stop having just one overworked employee. We can hire more people, then we can grow and do more work. They all had a different story. There was another insurance agent who owned a bunch of restaurants, same story. Reinvest in that business. Pay my employees more. Show them I appreciate them. Major corporations in America mandating now a $15 an hour minimum wage for their own company. Not some falsely inflated nonsense. Bonuses going out to employees. It's going to be hard for the Democrats to stem the tide of what's going to look good for people next year. That's all I'm saying is what you're hearing from the media is that the Democrats are going to be in a walkover and take over the House. This is not the easy walkover they had hoped for, especially between now and June when people see their taxes go down, their wallets get fatter, people spending, jobs, increases in pay. Coming up at 8:20, switch gears just a little bit. There is an increase in the homicide rate in America. One third of that increase, one neighborhood in Chicago. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the differences in laws, gun laws and otherwise, and how it affects the entire nation. That comes up at 8:20. Again, my name is Mike Broomhead, and this, of course, is the Glenn Beck Program.
Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck.
All right, cause and effect. Sometimes the numbers don't tell the whole story. Sometimes they tell you more than you want to know. Chicago, Illinois. The United States saw a 9% increase, roughly 9% increase in homicides in 2016. More than one third of that increase came from the neighborhoods in Chicago, where just one third of residents live. Chicago and Baltimore have seen violence rise to or near 1990s levels in the past 2 years, where other cities have seen a drop. Los Angeles, dramatic drop in violence. Areas with 30% of the metropolis population are responsible for one quarter of the 13% drop in the nation's murder rate. The nation's capital has seen a decrease of murders. The Wall Street Journal analysis show that there have been taking place in sections of Chicago or Baltimore where poverty has worsened, as well as areas with less police presence than in the past. George Mason University criminologist research cited that the Wall Street Journal's authors showed that about 1% of the city streets produce 25% of the crime. 5% of the streets produce half of the crime. A couple of things going on here. Number one, people are talking about the assault on the FBI by our president. Well, I don't know if it's on the entire agency, but we know that at least one person at the FBI was so biased he couldn't keep his mouth shut during the Mueller investigation into collusion and investigating Hillary Clinton. I don't even need to go down that road, but the media is saying that it is a horrible thing that Donald Trump would say such things. President Obama, Eric Holder, the anti-police sentiment that seemed to permeate that administration. You look at the lack of respect for police officers that has permeated our society over the last few years. Every cop a good cop? Nobody thinks that. As a vocation, it's an honorable calling. There is no higher calling, I believe, than those that would protect their community. And I am unashamedly pro-law enforcement. I will call out a bad cop at a moment's notice. We've seen the video evidence of a police officer shooting a suspect in the back and then moving evidence so that he could try to get himself out of what he had just done in murdering another human being while wearing a badge. That cop should be punished to a greater extent because of the power of that badge. And most cops would tell you that. But there is no doubt that what we saw, Michael Brown, hands up, don't shoot, Ferguson, Missouri, was a lie. Hands up, don't shoot was a lie. And it's a shame that Michael Brown lost his life. I mean that sincerely. 18 years old. I want you to think about what you were at 18. I know what I was at 18. I was different at 28, 38, and 48. Fortunately for me, I had those years to turn things around and be different. Michael Brown made a horrible choice in attacking a police officer, not once but twice, and he lost his life because of it. Eric Holder went to Ferguson, Missouri himself, and he met with protest groups, and he said, I know how you feel. I've been racially profiled. I've been pulled over. My brother and I were stopped running for a movie in Washington, D.C., and I was already an attorney. But because we were black and running down the street, the police stopped us. I don't ever mind being known as an activist attorney general. Those are words from Eric Holder. So part of the issue is an anti-police sentiment, a disrespect for authority, number one. Number two is a complete lack of respect for human life. Now, I live in a state where the gun laws are as lenient as possible. In the state of Arizona, if you legally own a handgun, you can conceal it without a permit. Now, I maintain a concealed carry permit. I like the reciprocity. I like the level of commitment it takes to hold that permit, proficiency. But here in Arizona, you can conceal a weapon if you legally own it. And there were many of those that thought when the law was changed to that there'd be blood in the streets. And I'm here to tell you, this is a safe place to live. We have our issues like any other city does, but it is a safe place to live. Chicago has some of the most strict gun laws in the country. So does D.C. Baltimore as well, I believe. And yet some of the highest gun crime rates. Once again, it's not the tool they use. It's the lack of character and the violent nature of the person wielding the weapon. Whether they're behind the wheel of a car with a knife, a sword in their hand, a blowtorch, or a rifle, or a .22 pistol. It is the character of the person wielding the weapon. But if Chicago, Illinois is adding a third of the increase in homicides out of a couple of neighborhoods in Chicago, who's at fault here? Well, poverty's at fault. No, it's not. I grew up in those neighborhoods. I've seen the criminal element. I grew up in those neighborhoods. My mother never let us equate poverty with bad, poor with dirty. Rat hole apartments, my mom always cleaned the place. Vacuumed, spotless. And the fact of the matter is, that it's a lack of respect for any human life whatsoever. Those numbers are staggering. They should break our hearts that there is a generation of young men and women that are going to be lost in Chicago. Maybe not all dead, but definitely lost. When standing behind a gun is the answer to a problem, it's a shame. People have children, they're passed those morals or lack of them onto their children. I want you to think about that number. One third of the increases in the number of homicides in 2016, a third can be attributed to some Chicago neighborhoods. You know, the answer is not an easy solution, but if someone wants to look at the guns as the problem, you can disarm a lot of people, and you're not going to change what they do in Chicago if this is the mindset of the people in those neighborhoods. I think it's something to really consider. Mitch McConnell and his agenda, what he says the agenda of the United States Senate will be next year. lot different than what Paul Ryan said. A lot different than Paul Ryan's. Is Mitch McConnell setting himself up for failure in the United States Senate? And if so, will somebody get to him and change his mind? That's coming up. And before we get out of here, we'll talk about ISIS and just how far they've fallen as well. Stick around.
Glenn Beck. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
You know that Mitch McConnell has kind of broken off Paul Ryan saying that entitlement reform is going to be next on the agenda in the House of Representatives. They're going to work on the entitlement programs. One of the things that's not happened with this new tax reform bill is we haven't seen a lot about tax cuts. I've maintained, I continue to maintain, will continue to maintain forever and ever and ever that we do not have an income problem in the United States Treasury. We have set records almost every single year of the Obama presidency for dollars into the United States Treasury. I'm not making those numbers up. We have spent at over $1 trillion in deficits every single year of that presidency. Deficits continue, no doubt about it. They are still deficit spending right now. Can't lay that at the feet of anybody. Republicans control it all. When do we start seeing spending cuts? Well, Mitch McConnell says that in the Senate, the Democrats aren't going to go along with entitlement reform. It's just not going to happen. So they're going to look at infrastructure. The president wants a bipartisan infrastructure bill. Well, I have a couple of questions about infrastructure. I thought we fixed that with the stimulus package. The shovel-ready programs that drove me out of my mind. And here's the difference. If you remember, President Bush and corporations that were too big to fail. And a lot of people said, let them fail. What do you mean too big to fail? Let them fail. Somebody will fill the gap. No, we can't do that. If propping those businesses up with billions and billions and, you know, $1 trillion of your tax money was the way to go, and those businesses use that money in the wrong way, the American people would be outraged and should be. I'll give you an example of the difference between the two. With the stimulus package with President Obama and the idea of fixing infrastructure in the United States, highways expanding and then road signs up that said, hey, listen, this is your stimulus dollars at work. We're expanding this freeway. We're doing this. That is not a permanent solution. That is a temporary job. So what you've done is you fix some infrastructure. And I'm getting to the point of the infrastructure in just a moment. The difference would be something that is a continuing revenue generator. So for a private business that was propped up by the stimulus package of George W. Bush, for them to take that money and remodel the corporate bathrooms and say, hey, listen, we hired a contractor, we hired a bunch of subcontractors, and you know, we spent $65,000 or $80,000 remodeling the bathrooms, which is a ridiculously low number for an executive restroom, but we spent a few a few hundred thousand dollars remodeling the restrooms of the stimulus money. So we employed probably 10 people throughout that process to get that thing done. Maybe a dozen people were for 6 months fixing up those corporate restrooms. But at the end of that 6 months, the money's gone. So are those jobs. As opposed to using that money to make sure that whatever it is that they do at that place, they're doing better and hiring more people in permanent jobs so that that money is an investment that continues to grow as opposed to just a nice bathroom for people to visit a few times a day. Well, the shovel-ready projects of a stimulus package did exactly the same thing under Barack Obama. We're going to fix the roads. We're going to do this. We're going to put some things in. How did they create jobs that carried on? They didn't. But what we did, according to the stimulus package from what I saw, was infrastructure. It was going to kill two birds with one stone. That's why we had to go into so much debt. If you remember, we've got to fix this George W. Bush economy. We've got to get Americans working again. So instead of putting people on the public dole, we're going to kill two birds with one stone. We're going to hire people to fix the infrastructure because we know the infrastructure is crumbling in America. That's what we were told. Now we need another infrastructure bill. So I'm a little skeptical to begin with. But I'm also a little skeptical of Mitch McConnell's reasoning here. He said at an event last week, he would not expect to see the Senate tackle entitlement reform next year. He said, I think the Democrats will not be interested in entitlement reform. So I would not expect to see that on the agenda. He's worried about the Democrats killing these bills. Now, there's going to be some that can, and there's going to be some that can't. But as the leader in the United States Senate, you're supposed to be able to set the agenda and then rally people around the agenda. Can you get full Republican support? You should be able to. Can you get some Democrats to support it? You should be able to. And some of the states that are moderate, some of those swing states and moderate states, absolutely you should be able to. But what we've done is created a system where no one is told no in America. It used to be that the Republicans and the Democrats and whoever had power got to set the committee chair people and the agenda. But in the end, there was a negotiation process where they realized we have a small amount of money between us. And what we're going to do is fight for the deal breakers. And we're going to hope that if we're in the minority, that we are able to get some of what we want, get as much of what we want as we can. And what we've created is a society where no one is told no. The budgets continue, continuing resolutions, no oversight of the money. The agencies are fully funded and then some, and then they spend their budget so that they get more next year. And we see huge waste. Talked yesterday about a clown school in Argentina. And it wasn't a joke. So what are we doing to rein in spending? I mean, unless, of course, you're someone that doesn't believe that we have an income, you know, that we don't have an income problem. The example I've used many times on my show in Phoenix, and I'll use it again now, is a superstar like Elton John. And this isn't to make fun of Elton John. This is a simple fact. Elton John went bankrupt. So did Michael Jackson. Anybody think that either one of those two people had an income problem? Of course they didn't. Elton John still makes a huge income. His music still sells millions and millions of copies. It's still played on radio stations across the country, across the world. He still sells out concert arenas and gets paid large sums of money to perform. What Elton John did is what the American government does. He spent beyond his incredible income. He even admitted to that. You know, $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 barbecues on the weekend at his house. Lavish parties all the time, all over the world, properties everywhere. What he was able to do was rein in the spending, live reasonably within his means, which for most of us would be a dream anyway. And the income kept coming because he is a talented, wealthy individual. Well, America is a talented, wealthy nation. Entrepreneurs, highly qualified people, forward-thinking, leading the world. Now, they're saying by 2032, I saw a story that said China's going to overtake the American economy. Whether that's true or not, we don't know. But just to give you an idea, what are we, how much smaller are we than the billions of people that are in China? We're about a third of the size of the Chinese population, and yet our economy leads the world. And I believe we'll continue to lead the world. We are talented, highly, you know, the country has got a very huge income. What we've done is decided we are not going to tell anybody no when we're going to spend outside of our means. The Republicans, when they have control, are terrified about entitlement reform. There you go, balancing the budget again on the backs of the poor. No, we're balancing the budget. Well, you gave tax cuts to the rich, and now you're going to balance that off by cutting entitlement to the poor. All right. If that's the way you want to see it, that's the way you should see it. Look at your cell phone bill. Everyone should look at their cell phone bill once in a while and take a look at the taxes and fees that are attached to your phone bills. And it all has to do with free cell phones for people and programs, and that's what we've turned into. I railed on the estate tax the other day. I think it's ghoulish. I don't care if it's only on the mega wealthy in this country. We're stealing from the dead. We have gone to such lengths because we cannot keep up with the amount of money we've allowed our government to spend. America does not have a spending problem or an income problem. It has a spending problem. And Mitch McConnell says he's not going to take up entitlement reform because the Democrats won't want to. I think Mitch McConnell needs to learn how to fight. I think Mitch McConnell should be up at the podium saying the Democrats do not want to talk about entitlement reform while we continue to spend at billions and billions, almost trillions of dollars in deficit still. They don't want to talk about getting rid of the abuse and the inefficiency that goes on within these systems. The Democrats want to keep spending at deficit level. Instead of fighting that way, Mitch McConnell says, the Democrats aren't going to want to do it, so we're going to have to go to something else. I don't think that's the right way to be in leadership. Don't know Mitch McConnell. Never met him. Not a personal axe to grind. Not calling the guy Satan incarnate. I'm just saying he doesn't sound to me like he's much of an effective leader right now if he's already saying we're not going to do this next year because the Democrats don't want to. You are the leader of the United States Senate. It's your job to rally your people, rally your caucus, and whatever you have to do to drag some of the others with you, you need to do it. Some good news. If you remember that, well, as President Obama said, the JV squad called ISIS and how they ran roughshod over the top of the Iraqis and took over a big chunk of that country. They controlled the Syrian border, the entire border between Syria and Iraq. Well, there's news about ISIS and what they've lost just from the rules of engagement changes that were made when President Trump took office. So that comes up here in just a few moments, and we'll talk more about holiday spending. And of course, we can't go through this day without talking about the Trump dossier and CNN. So all that's still coming up on the show. I'm Mike Broomhead, and this is the Glenn Beck Program.
Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck.
You know, politics and the military clash a lot of times as well. Ask a Vietnam veteran about that. And what I mean by that is I've always believed that in leadership, one of the best things to do is surround yourself with people that are great at what they do and then let them do what they're great at. Ronald Reagan was terrific at this. I heard from all people, I got to be honest with you, Senator John McCain was talking to me very early in the Trump presidency and said that this is the best cabinet he's seen assembled in years and years and years. And that the men and women that the president had surrounded himself with were excellent people. And you look at the foreign policy, and I thought foreign policy was going to be a very weak point for President Trump at a time when the country needed somebody that was strong in international policy and foreign policy because of the mess that was made during the Obama presidency. And, you know, I am a registered Republican, but I'm not a hater. I don't hate Democrats. I'm not just looking to bash Democrats at every turn. The foreign policy of the Obama administration was abysmal. The fact that John Kerry was our Secretary of State should make us all hang our head in shame or laugh hysterically, maybe both. If you remember in response, I believe it was the Charlie Hebdo murders that happened in Paris. If you remember, it was a week and a half before the Americans responded, and the French are our oldest ally. And in response, I remember like it was yesterday, I was doing my show, my morning show, and we were out at a home show here. So we were out in the middle of a home show, and my producer said to me, "Have you seen this video?" And I said, "No." And I watched it, and I thought it was a Saturday Night Live skit. I thought it was a parody. I said, "That cannot be real." He said, "Oh, it's real." The American official response to the tragic murders in Paris was John Kerry, our Secretary of State, took James Taylor to Paris to sing "You've Got a Friend" to the French people. Do you remember? I mean, right now you're embarrassed as an American and laughing because you probably had forgotten about that. That was our foreign policy. The Iranians at every turn shouted death to America throughout the process of the nuclear deal. The Ayatollah was speaking in public, and the crowd began to chant death to America in Farsi. He responded, "Yes, of course, death to America." One of the military leaders, one of the generals from the Iranian army said, "It doesn't matter what deal is ever struck, the Americans will always be our enemy." I believe there are 200 members of the Iranian parliament were voting. And during the vote, members of their parliament were shouting death to America, in which this anti-American bill passed 199-1. And I imagine the one vote for in our favor, that guy probably was never seen again. So at every level of the Iranian government, they shouted death to America while John Kerry and the president of the United States negotiated behind the scenes to make sure that Hezbollah could sell drugs in America and weren't punished for it. We now know that's true as well. It's also the president that called ISIS the JV squad, if you remember. The JV squad then that took over the entire Syrian-Iraqi border, major portions of the nation of Iraq. ISIS has lost 98% of the territory it once held, with half of that terror group's so-called caliphate having been recaptured since President Trump took office less than a year ago. The massive gains come after years of erroneous rules, or onerous rules. The micromanagement by the Obama administration. The rules of engagement under Obama administrations were onerous. I mean, what we were doing, have individual target determinations being conducted by the White House. Surround yourself with good people and then let them do what they're good at. That's what they've done. And they unleashed the American military and we're winning. Talk about holiday spending, the Trump dossier, all that coming up in the next hour. Stick around.
Glenn Beck. Love. Courage. Truth. Glenn Beck.
Happy New Year. Merry Christmas from the Glenn Beck Program. My name is Mike Broomhead. I'm in Phoenix, Arizona. Last day in for Glenn. Doc Thompson will be in, I believe, the next couple of days. So let's talk about, first of all, political motivation, because we're going to get into the holiday spending numbers, which should be good news for everybody in America, but it's bad news for some people. And I'm surprised at this. Is there always room for improvement? There always is. It's one of the great things about our country is that as great as we've been, we find new ways to improve. And taking inventory, as a matter of fact, let me start there. We have valid conversations in this country about things that are issues that should always be discussed here. I have a great privilege where I live to speak to high school students across, you know, this part of Arizona. And I go a few times a year and speaking to social studies departments, government classes, that kind of thing. And I don't give a speech. I would rather get questions from high school students. And as much as we talk about public education and there's a problem in our schools and the dumbing down of America, I will tell you that the classrooms that I go into, actually they're more assemblies that I go into, you know, the kids ask the same questions we ask. They're concerned about the same things we're concerned about. And there are some real issues that are out there to be discussed. There's always room for improvement. And your issue, your problem is a real problem for you, whatever that is. We talk about wage inequality. We talk about civil rights. We talk about race relations. We talk about the LGBT community. All of these things that happen in America, and they're valid conversations. But I think maybe for just a moment at this time of year, before we talk about the money side of things right now, let's take some inventory. We still lead the world. Do you realize that we argue in this country about wage inequality? And we should. I have two girls that I love with all of my heart. And I want those two young women to realize that if they want to accomplish something, they should feel like they're able to, that their gender should not impede their success as long as they are physically, intellectually able to do that job. And it's kind of an American principle. It's a great time, I think, to be a woman in America. I mean, the Harvey Weinstein, Al Franken stuff aside, but you mirror that with the rest of the world. You know in Saudi Arabia what the big changes are this past year in 2017? The Saudis have allowed women to drive cars. I want you to think about, you know, an industrialized country. Now, obviously, living under religious law and a lot of things that happen there, but think of the differences there in the conversations and how many decades behind rights they are when just now women are able to drive. There are still many countries that we would do business with that women are more property than they are individuals. Look how far we've come in leading the world in that regard. I'm not saying we don't have a long way to go. I'm not saying that there aren't real issues that should be discussed. But for a moment, let's at least recognize where we are and who we are. The former president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, was at a UN assembly and decided to go and speak to a university in New York City while he was here. And during the speech, he told these university students that there are no gay people in Iran, to which the student body laughed out loud at him. And he was indignant and said, there aren't. The truth of the matter is, there obviously are, but they're in hiding or they are put to death. Does that mean we don't have a ways to go or improvements that can be made in the relations between the gay and straight communities and the way people treat each other in this country? No, it doesn't mean that at all. I'm saying for a moment, why not take inventory on how we lead the world in many ways? Poverty, the poor in America, real problem, real issue. I talked with a man from, I believe he was from Ethiopia. He crossed into another country and was homeless there for 7 years, waiting for his visa to come through to come to America and get on a pathway to citizenship. And he was homeless for 7 years, left his family behind. And he must have said, God bless America, 15 times in the short cab ride from the hotel in Vegas to the airport. And talking about American politics, he laughed and said, you know, you guys argue and fight and call each other names. We shoot each other in my country. And being homeless there, it's not like being homeless here. You go days without a meal there. No shelter. The way we are in America leads the world in many ways. We should always be looking to improve. But why not at least acknowledge a little bit of what we do and how we do it here? Because now, looking for a moment at what happened over the holidays, MasterCard said Americans spent about $800 billion for the holidays. Record spending. 4.9% growth year over year. Biggest jump since 2011. Consumer confidence is very high. Stock market setting records. Your 401k, my 401k, IRAs going up, getting stronger. American businesses getting stronger because they're going to have more of their money back. And yet, the Bernie Sanders of the world, the Paul Krugmans of the world, the Nancy Pelosi's of the world are all saying, this is death to America. This is doom and gloom. This is going to be horrible. Why? Politics. There's always got to be a villain in politics, right? There's got to be somebody that the government has to defend you against. It's the old argument of setting up the straw man and then they're going to knock it down. I talked about immigration and the man I met who left his son when he was 2 years old and didn't see his son again until he was 17 years old. Now he's a citizen. His children are citizen. He had a daughter that was born here. He owns a home outside of Las Vegas. Told me all this in the cab ride. God bless America. Legal immigrant. Immigration in this country, illegal immigration. Remember, we are deporting people and separating families. Legal immigration separates families. This man didn't see his son for 15 years, nor his wife. And he just talked about what a great wife he had, that for all of those years, she would raise his son and take care of his children until he could bring her here, and she did. And after he went through the process of becoming a citizen of this country and was able to bring his family here, now they are all citizens and he has an American-born daughter. And he just kept saying over and over again, God bless America. So on the immigration argument, what do we tell those legal immigrants? What do you tell a man that spent 7 years homeless waiting for a visa and 15 years without seeing his family, that now we're going to take people that have snuck across the border and we're going to make them the same, give them the same standing he has? What do you say to the Cubans that got on fishing boats and got on shrimp boats that crossed and went into Freedom Town and spent weeks there going through the screening process to become citizens of this country the right way and to do things the legal way. What do you say to those immigrants when you tell them that a family that sneaks across the border now is demanding in-state tuition and full standing as American citizens? What do you say to them? To the people that bared the expense? What do you say to the people that bore the expense of all of that? But we have the argument, and it's always us against them. And in this case, all of the dreamers in this country are good, upstanding people that no fault of their own, that I feel for them. I think the dreamers deserve protection under American laws. But there's a price to be paid. And there's a price to be paid because the people that did it legally paid a price. It's always been my dream to bring my family to America. So I did it illegally, but I did it. And now I want free. I want the same standing as the people that did it the right way. That's not fair. We're a nation that's supposed to be fair. And yet the Democratic Party now is setting up the straw man. We've got to protect the dreamers. We have to protect the dreamers from the Republicans. And the Republicans are shrugging their shoulders right now. And they're saying, we've been working with the White House since the president said you have 6 months to fix DACA legislatively the way it should have been done in the first place instead of by executive order. I'm repealing this executive order. They have until March. And every Republican in the Congress has shrugged their shoulders and said, I don't know what they're talking about. We've been working on this with the White House. We're working on it. No, we got to protect the dreamers. Why? Election year. So next year during the election cycle, when something is done for the dreamers, Bernie Sanders and Nancy Pelosi can call it a victory for Democrats, because without them, the dreamers wouldn't have had the protection and the Republicans would have done to them what they did to the poor people by giving the rich the tax cuts. American politics can be dirty, and it's a shame. It happens on both sides of the aisle, but it's a shame. I'm blown away by the way we're fooled by the sound bites of people in American politics. Have a long memory. It's helpful. The anti-Trump sentiment that permeates our society has gone to some very big lengths, from the two scoops of ice cream to other things. At 9:20, the obsession that CNN has with the Trump dossier, and there is still one CNN reporter reporting that the Republicans paid for the dossier. And it is erroneous. It's harmful. So we're going to talk about some of this. And Melania Trump being maligned for having a tree cut down at the White House. I mean, it sounds silly, but it's just one more level of how they're demonizing the sitting president and the first lady of the United States. So all that coming up at 9:20. A little bit later on, I want you to meet an author of a book, The Social Justice Warrior's Handbook, which is a tongue-in-cheek look at the politically correct in our world. We'll do that before we get out of here as well. My name is Mike Broomhead, and this is the Glenn Beck Program.
Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck.
You know, the obsession with the Trump dossier and what's happened from the left, it's a great question. We've talked about this investigation, and depending on where you are politically, again, we are picking sides. And to be honest with you, this is one area where I haven't picked sides. And what I mean by that is I've maintained from the very beginning, because I was not all in as a Trump supporter. Now, if you've listened to the show the last couple of days, it probably sounds like I've been wearing a Make America Great Again hat since day one. Not the truth. Trump was not my first choice in the primary, not by a long shot, not at all. He's the president. Now I wanted to be successful. I've been turned into a Trump defender in the interest of truth. And what I mean by that is we hear nothing of truth from CNN or MSNBC or largely any of the news publications out there. It's jaded, it's anti-Trump, and it's actually kind of silly and a little bit insulting to anybody who can see. But I have maintained from the beginning that if the president's campaign on any level colluded with the Russians to change our election, the American people have a right to know. If the laws were broken, someone should pay. Even if laws weren't broken, the voters have a right to know in the next election cycle if the president colluded with a foreign government to change the election. So from the beginning, I was in favor of an investigation. Clear the air. Let's hear what they have to say. But if you look what this investigation has turned into, it's pretty clear that it has been slanted because the lead investigator, one of them, Peter Strzok is his name, was as anti-Trump of person as you could have chosen for anything. And everybody has an opinion. Law enforcement officers have opinions. You have to be able to maintain some kind of neutrality in your decision making. A detective will tell you two things are most important about being a detective. Number one is go where the evidence takes you. Don't take the evidence where you want it to go. Go where the evidence takes you. And secondly, it's not what you know, it's what you can prove. Frustrating to a police officer or a detective on any level. A lot of things they feel like they know, it's what they can prove. Peter Strzok sending messages with a colleague talking about what a horrible person Trump is. This while he was investigating Hillary Clinton for the email scandal. Now, at the risk of insulting someone who knows better, I'm going to explain something to you. Hillary Clinton broke the law. There's no doubt that Hillary Clinton broke the law. There is a room in every secure building. Top secret documents are kept there. That room is called the SCIF. Anybody that's ever been with a security clearance knows that there's a room called the SCIF. Top secret, top level documents, confidential documents are kept in that room. If there are documents in that room for you to read, they will send you an email that says you have documents in the SCIF. You leave all of your electronic recording devices, your cell phone, everything else stays outside of that room. You sign into that room. You read the documents that are assigned to you. You don't remove those documents. You don't take photographs. You leave the room, you sign out, you go away. If you remove a document from that room, it doesn't matter where you go with it. It doesn't matter if you put it in your pocket, rip it up, flush it down the toilet. It doesn't matter what happens. Removing a document from that room is against the law. So in the world we live in, I'm 50 years old, the world we've all grown up in, that makes perfect sense. If Hillary Clinton had gone into the SCIF, taken a document from that room and walked to her desk and set it on her desk, put it in a drawer, put it in her purse, it didn't matter. It's against the law. She did that digitally. She took documents on a private server that she owned and set up and transmitted and received those documents amongst the people close to her. She broke the law. But in correspondence, this guy Peter Strzok is talking with this girl that says to him, maybe you are where you are to stop or to protect America from this menace, meaning Donald Trump and the possibility of him being elected president. He responds that there are many ways that he can protect his nation and hope and doesn't know if it would help. This is when he was supposed to have an unbiased investigation into the Hillary Clinton scandal and the emails. He was also the guy assigned to interviewing Michael Flynn. Somebody tell me this is an unbiased investigation in the eyes of anybody that's reasonable. So the obsession with the dossier that got this all started, one CNN reporter claims, now this is in a story that just yesterday, Evan Perez told the network viewers on Tuesday, yesterday, that the anti-Trump Republicans first funded the infamous Trump dossier. Not true. Not true. They had the organization that was hired that ended up getting the dossier done with information, opposition research. Well, once Trump became the nominee, there was no need for any Republicans to need the information. So this company went to the Democrats and said, we've got it. Do you want it? The DNC said yes. The Clinton campaign said yes. So they took that information. The law firm that represented both the DNC and the Clinton campaign, they commissioned the dossier to be done. That dossier was then created. And now the real questions are, was that dossier used as evidence in a FISA court to get a FISA order to surveil the Trump campaign? Because the dossier has been debunked. There are accusations in that dossier against Donald Trump that his lawyers produced evidence he wasn't even in the country when those accusations were made. So if the dossier's been debunked and CNN is still trotting it out there, A, is factual, and B, someone on their network claims that the Republicans paid for the dossier, you tell me how the American people are getting an unbiased view of the news and the information they need to know so they can decipher for themselves. The Melania Trump story makes me laugh of what they've done to Melania Trump, as dumb as it sounds. Put out a tweet saying that Melania Trump ordered a tree to be removed that's 200 years old from the White House grounds. And they reported back and said, no, the tree's been falling down for years. It's being completely held up by unnatural means. It's being supported and it's falling apart and it's a hazard. Just silly. Want you to meet an author. Her name is Lisa De Pasquale, The Social Justice Warrior's Handbook. Stick around.
Glenn Beck. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Hey, thanks for being here with us. My name is Mike Broomhead, in for Glenn for just a little while longer. Thanks for being a part of the show. Social, if you are a social media user on Instagram, I am Mike Broomhead, all one word. I am the king of blurry pictures. So you can follow me on Instagram. Mike Broomhead is my handle there. I'm at Broomhead Show on Twitter. Don't tweet Mike Broomhead. That's some guy in Great Britain that's furious about getting my tweets. So I'm at Broomhead Show on Twitter, or the Mike Broomhead Show fan page on Facebook is how you can reach me. I can only give you my perspective on things. That's the only way I've ever been able to do any of this. I come from a working class family. My uncles were Teamsters. I was born in Northeast Ohio, but grew up in Florida. So I say I'm from Florida because I don't remember much about Ohio. But I still have cousins all over the Midwest. And so there is a work ethic there. My uncles were Teamsters. They were working class Democrats when I was a little kid. I've got no ill will towards the Democratic Party or people that believe in the ideology of the Democratic Party. Where I have a problem is the people on the far left that believe that because, I'll give you an example, because I am a Second Amendment advocate, that somehow I don't care about dead kids at Sandy Hook Elementary. And I will tell you this, just in regard to that one story. I was doing afternoons at KFYI. I do morning drive at KFYI, which is stationed in Phoenix, Arizona now. I was doing afternoon drive then. And I was in our newsroom doing show prep when the story of the Sandy Hook shooting first came out, and that there were fatalities at an elementary school. And as the day progressed, we learned and saw that number go up. And then we found out that it was an entire classroom full of first graders that had been gunned down. And I, for the first time, probably in my life, but definitely in my career, was speechless. I was so sick to my stomach that one of the people I reached out to was Glenn Beck. And I said, how do you make sense of this? I have a 3-hour show. How do I go on the air for 3 hours and talk reasonably about a young man who murders his mother at point blank range and then guns down an entire classroom full of first graders? So for anyone to categorize me as someone who doesn't care about dead children because I'm a Second Amendment advocate is probably the most insulting thing that's ever been said to or about me. There's something in religion and in ministry that anybody that's ever gone through a seminary will tell you is called apologetics. And apologetics is being able to defend your faith. It's not just about being able to tell somebody what you believe, but describe why you believe it. And it's important for anybody, if you attend a church or, you know, your church's doctrine, to explain why you believe what you believe. But it's that way with anything. So I have a defense of my Second Amendment stance. I am able to defend why I believe what I believe and why I don't think making it more difficult for me to get a firearm makes us a less safe or makes us a more safe country. As a matter of fact, it's the other way around. And how I can maintain my strong stance on the Second Amendment and my right to keep and bear arms and have it still be consistent with wanting to end the mass shootings all over this country. And yet, for the people on the far left, the fact that I am pro-Second Amendment means I don't care about dead children. That's where my problem lies. That because I'm in favor of tax cuts for the rich, the middle class, the working class, whatever you want to call anybody, I am in favor of anybody getting more of their own money back, that somehow I don't care about the working poor in America. Most of my life, I was the working poor in America. So it's defeating that political argument, this definitive you are what I say you are mentality that has driven me and makes me really happy to do this for a living. I was asked a little less than a year ago to write a book, which really shocked me because I figured if I ever wrote a book, it would come with a box of crayons. And there is a woman named Lisa De Pasquale who is an author. And she's written a book called Social Justice Warriors Handbook. And she was tasked with helping me do this. So I want you to meet Lisa. Lisa, are you there?
Yes. Hey, how are you?
All right. I'm doing well. Let's talk about, first of all, tell me about your book, because reading your book is a lot of, there really is a lot in there that really, really did make me LOL. I laughed out loud at a lot of the things you've written. Tell me about the principle of the book.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely want listeners to know that it is a parody of Social Justice Warriors, but it's all true. I mean, this is the way they think. They are really this outraged about, you know, little things like, you know, the song Baby It's Cold Outside and, you know, anything that you can think of. And that's because, you know, once you start to monetize outrage, you can find it under a rock. And it's a fun read because you'll see a lot of truth in it. But I think it also, like you were talking about before, really shows what, you know, the left's playbook is. And that's just, rather than coming up with ideas, it's just being like perpetually outraged.
Every family has this in it somewhere, whether it's one person or the majority or whatever. There is a political argument that's going to happen during the holidays that's going to involve probably a little bit of wine at dinner, and it's going to deteriorate into a fight. This book is actually a way to kind of disarm that in a way, because it's a funny look at the social justice warriors.
Yeah, I mean, and there's so much material there, you know, obviously to laugh at. And that's why I wanted to just present it in a different way, because, you know, I don't want to be angry all the time. I'm sure you don't want to be angry all the time. And I think the best way to disarm that side and to, you know, get new people on, you know, thinking about these issues is to show them, like, look, this is what they actually, you know, believe. It's funny.
It is funny. And then to categorize it in a humorous way, if someone's got a sense of humor, at least they're going to be able to see the humor in it. So you were asked, and I mean, I think it's because I asked you, if you would write this with me when we were asked to write it, because obviously I'm not an author. You figured that out very quickly in working with me. But working with you has been a lot of fun on this book. And the name of the book is If You're Going to Be Dumb, You Better Be Tough. And a perfect title for a book that I would write.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you tell me, tell me about the process of working with me. How did you like the process?
No, it was interesting because, you know, I listened to your show and I listen obviously whenever you fill in for Glenn, and you know, I would get mad at you when you would start to tell stories that are in the book, because there's a lot of like really good stuff in there. And I get mad at you if you talk about it on the radio, or if you talk on the radio a story that I didn't put in the book. So it was always, you know, adding, because that's where a lot of the really good stories are. It's not with, you know, someone who's famous that you already know everything about or that already presents, you know, some PR version of themselves. You know, the real stories are, you know, in everyday people, and that's what you are.
It's interesting because I didn't want to write anything autobiographical. I think that that's nobody want to read that part of the story. But the lessons I've learned from the people that I care about the most, and hopefully that comes across. I think you've done a very good job of putting the nonsense that we did for hours of talking into a you know, what is a fairly short book. But I appreciate the hard work that you've done on it. And you know, I got to tell you, Lisa is a brilliant writer. She's written more than one book. The Social Justice Warriors Handbook is a really funny book. If you want to get a great gift for somebody, if you forgot somebody on your Christmas list, where can they get your book? Because mine's not coming out until May.
Yeah, they can get the Social Justice Warrior Handbook on Amazon. They can get My new novel that just came out in November called I Wish I Might. If you're like frustrated with women's magazines and women's media, it's a novel. And it's sort of, it's like the handbook in that it talks about those issues, but like in a more fun way. It's not like a preachy book about women's media. You know, it's just like a fun romance novel. And that's also on Amazon. And, you know, just follow me on Twitter at LisaDEP.
Lisa DEP on Twitter. She's a great follow there as well. She likes to rile people up. So I appreciate you coming on for a few minutes, Lisa.
Thanks for having me.
All right, thanks. That's Lisa DePasquale. You can follow her on Twitter, Lisa DEP on Twitter. I've never thought that I would write, but I wanted to thank the people that have been most influential. Glenn is thanked in the book. I have an entire chapter about Glenn Beck in there and how he's helped me in many ways. My background's obviously not in broadcasting. If you listened over the last couple of days, you'll probably figure out pretty quickly I'm not a professional broadcaster, but I have had very good people influence me in my life. And my grandfather was my biggest influence in my life. My grandfather was the male role model to me. And he died when I was 9 years old. And I can tell you stories. That was 41 years ago. I can tell you stories about my grandfather like they were yesterday. When I was at the Republican National Convention, it was the first time I had been in Cleveland, Ohio since 1979. I had not been in Ohio since I was a very young boy. And I hadn't been there since. And I GPS'd, put it in the car, and I drove to my old neighborhood. I remembered my old address, didn't remember my grandparents' house, my best friend across the street didn't remember his house. I had to call my mom to get the address to find out where these people lived. And driving through that neighborhood, I remember driving down one street, and all of a sudden it all came flooding back to me because there were memories of my grandfather. And I drove down the street, and I said, there's the lake my grandfather taught me to fish in. And all the memories were tied to him. And now I've got four grandsons. And I see the future in those four boys. And I wonder, 40 years from now, will they remember stories about me? Any stories about me? Can I be a piece of influence in their lives that they have been in mine? And also, all these issues we talk about, when I'm on for Glenn or I'm doing my show in Phoenix, they all have a face now. You want to talk about $20 trillion in debt? My oldest grandson is 6 and a half. Less than 20 years, he's going to be in the workforce in some capacity or another. What are we turning the keys, you know, over to? And that to me is a big concern. Tucker Carlson did something hysterical. He talked about the 100 racist things of 2017. So we've got kind of a top 10 list and some things before I close it out here. Again, if you want to follow Lisa DePasquale on Twitter, she is Lisa DEP on Twitter. Great follow. You can find her Social Justice Warriors handbook as well. And we'll talk about my social media coming up here in a few moments. I'm Mike Broomhead. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck.
All right, thanks for being here. It's the Glenn Beck Program. I'm Mike Broomhead in Phoenix, Arizona, here for a few more moments. You know, to have a sense of humor about some of the things out there, it's necessary. So much on college campuses, so much in our high schools. But to be honest with you, I've seen reality. The reality is that kids are pretty bright, that not everybody on a college campus is beside themselves with idiocy. But what's funny about it is it's that small minority that seems to be speaking for everyone else. Well, it makes sense. We have a 24-hour news cycle right now where everything has to be breaking news. They're not going to put somebody on a college campus on that says, you know, I really do wonder about what's going on in our country sometimes, and I really hope for the best, and I try to vote my conscience. No, they're going to put the person on with the, you know, four different color hair that looks like their face fell into a tackle box that gets on and talks about social justice and nonsense. So Tucker Carlson took a pretty funny look at 100 different racist things of 2017, and they really are hysterical. The tamarisk trees in Palm Springs, California. If you're a golfer, and or like me, someone who thinks they're a golfer, you realize that when they line a fairway with these trees, it's as much about protecting the houses and the things on the other side of those trees as anything else. Because I have the ability to hit the ball really far in the wrong direction. So they line the fairways with these trees. Well, they called the trees racist because this is a golf course. And we know only white people golf. And it's a classic black neighborhood on the other side of the trees. So to shield the white people from seeing this blight. Oy, oy, oy. So that was one of the big racist things of 2017, which when you look at how it works is pretty funny. They talk about the ice cream truck song being racist. Credit scores are classically racist. White people have good credit. Non-white people don't. And car insurance, crime statistics, and the list goes on and on and on. But what it does, what Tucker did in this, and he's growing on me more and more, by the way. I'm a fan of Tucker Carlson. And what it's pointing out is, once again, one more thing compounded on how we can be against each other. Here in Arizona, we had SB 1070, which is probably the only Senate bill I'll ever remember the number to ever. And SB 1070 was our immigration law change here years ago, largely held up by the Supreme Court. Parts of it were defeated through the federal courts. And what the intent of SB 1070 was to do was to give law enforcement in Arizona one law in which to go by, so that you weren't, you know, the sanctuary cities weren't going to happen, and that you weren't going to go from one jurisdiction to the other with immigration laws being enforced differently. But what it turned into was a political battle. And if you had listened to people, you would have thought that in Arizona, we had race wars in the street, that we were standing on opposite sides of the street and throwing rocks at each other. And it's just not the case. This is a wonderful place to live. And like most communities in this country, we have our differences. Like most people in this country, we have our differences with others. But we just want people to be able to coexist. You clean up your backyard, I'll clean up my backyard. I want to thank all of you for joining the show. Again, I'm at Broomhead Show on Twitter, the Mike Broomhead Show fan page on Facebook, or Mike Broomhead, all one word, on Instagram if you'd like to follow me. It's been a pleasure, as always, to be on, Glenn. I love the audience for Glenn Beck. Thanks for the interaction. Have a blessed and very happy, safe new year, and happy 2018. Thanks again, everyone, for having me be a part of your show. God bless.
Glenn Beck.